right. Yeah. Good morning, everyone. I call this meeting of the House Sustainable Infrastructure Policy Committee for February 8th, 2023 to order. Quorum is present, so we will get started. The first item on the agenda is approval of the minutes. Representative Anderson, would you like to move, make a motion to approve the minutes for February 1st, 2023?
Yes, Madam Chair, that's my motion.
Thank you. Representative Anderson moves approval of the minutes for February 1st, 2023. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 All those opposed, the minutes are approved. So first up on our agenda today is a presentation from the University of Minnesota on their local technical infrastructure assistance proposal. And so we have members can find a copy of the presentation in your packets. And so we have a number of folks from the U today, and I'm so happy that you guys are over here. And it's been a really cool relationship that we've developed over the past, well, first through Center of Transportation Studies, and then, you know, I had the seed of an idea. And so I've been working with the U for a while to try and kind of figure out how we can move what we've really been talking about in this committee forward. And so with that, I will turn it over to Dr. Kyle Shelton, and you can kind of introduce the rest of your team there. So.
Yeah, thanks, Madam Chair. Good morning, members. Thanks for having us. I'm Kyle Shelton. I'm the director of the Center for Transportation Studies. I'm joined by my colleague.
I'm Mary Vogel. I'm former director of the Center for Changing Landscapes and now with the Minnesota Design Center.
Thanks, Mary. We also have Linda Kingery, who is the interim statewide director for the Regional Sustainable Development Partnerships, Professor Tom Fisher from the Minnesota Design Center, and Professor Frank Doma from the Humphrey School for Public Affairs. And you'll hear from each of them along. We're going to do a little bit of musical chairs as we talk about those different units. But it's really a pleasure to speak with you all today and to talk a little bit about our proposed approach to supporting Minnesota's small communities in their infrastructure needs and across a diverse series of systems of infrastructure. I'm going to be setting the stage today, and then we'll hand off to each of my colleagues to talk a little bit more about their units. And while we're the organizers of this effort from our units within the university, we also want to be highlighting throughout the day that, as you all know, the university system has a really deep bench of experience and diverse backgrounds of research. And one of the things that we're really interested in doing with this effort is to make sure we're taking advantage of that deep bench and providing that expertise and experience to communities throughout the state to support their needs. And you'll also hear from some of those colleagues later after us about other topics, I know, with Jessica Hellman and Richard Graves talking. So we think, as we talk through this today, you'll really see that this proposal is a way for us to share that experience and fulfill the university system's mission to be partnering with and serving the needs of the residents of the state. So a little bit about what we're proposing. It's a partnership between small communities across Minnesota, our U of M system, and the state. And our proposal includes both a really intensive community-led project development process and ranges all the way up to high-level support for this committee and for the legislature generally and state agencies, thinking about what sustainability and resilient infrastructure could look like in policy and planning and projects. And we really think, again, the range of elements in this proposal helps this, allows the system to really provide as much support to communities as we can as we all work together to build that sustainable and resilient infrastructure. This is particularly important, as you all know, given the immense investments in infrastructure at the moment from the federal level down to what you all are working on at the state and local level. And in particular, we see a huge opportunity to help small communities access discretionary funds by really developing impactful, comprehensive projects across a range of needs and infrastructure systems. So that's a lot about what we want to talk about today. And I think, as you all know, often these smaller communities are really limited in their bandwidth and their capacity, whether that's volunteer leaders of townships or small staffs at small cities. There's a lot of room to offer support and help for those communities, and we're excited to be thinking about that. And we also will highlight as we go through that this proposal, I think, can dovetail with a number of other efforts, whether there be bigger structures that this committee or others want to put together, or we know that technical assistance will go beyond what we're proposing today, but we think it is a really helpful step alongside a lot of that. And as you can see here, we have two main goals for that. As I said, really helping level the playing field for small communities and developing these community-shaped projects and getting the competitive discretionary funding in their hands. And I think really also highlighting for you all the return on investment for this type of project, where if state dollars are going to these small communities through this program, it's also going to hopefully come back with those discretionary funds by putting projects together that are more effective and more competitive at the federal level, and ideally coming to you all in bonding projects that are much more comprehensive and fully developed across numerous needs. And then second, we want to help inform the policy planning and funding prioritization process that you all are helping to develop, thinking about sustainable and resilient projects and infrastructure, and we think there's a great opportunity to do that. All of this is going to center on implementable, practicable work, serving those needs, being community-driven. Mary's going to talk about some of the projects they have already done through the Minnesota Design Center and the Regional Sustainable Development Partnerships that really center the community's assets and what their key questions are. And we want to have that this intensive cohort really focus on that. As I said, it's also going to focus on the return on investment and making sure these projects have a deep impact in the communities. We want to use this as an opportunity to really identify and leverage existing federal funding resources, regional and state ones, and help those communities identify and pursue those. We also obviously, as I mentioned, want to deploy our experts and our folks at the university across the system to really hear from communities, work with communities in partnership around their questions and needs, and provide that support we can from the university. And we really see this as an opportunity to help support communities from the project conception all the way through execution. So what we're proposing is something that would go along with them every step of the way. This graphic I'll talk through from the smallest circle to the biggest. This is a quick conception of what we've been talking about. And the smallest circle is what we're calling the Empowering Communities Cohort that would be led by the Minnesota Design Center and RSDP. And what that looks like is what we're proposing is supporting 15 to 20 communities a year. And that is a very intensive process that Mary will talk more about, where they engage with the community across a long-term period of time, really talk about what is happening in the community, what questions and challenges they have, what assets and opportunities they see, and really helping to develop a really robust project and help address multiple needs there. The second circle is what we're proposing to sort of take advantage of the university system's deep bench. So having funds available for communities who may already have a project more fully developed or who aren't interested in taking the more time-intensive process, making sure there are resources available for them to help with anything from pre-engineering on a bridge to thinking about, hey, we have this recreational idea or park idea, we need to get it over this last step, or we want information to help inform our bonding proposal project about our new park or a new water system. And we think there are a variety of U of M system experts who can help with that. And then finally, the biggest circle, and I think this is pertinent to your committee, but also to other state partners, and really meshes with some of the climate action framework and other bigger work happening at the state level, is really thinking about how we can support, again, the policy planning and implementation of resilient and sustainable infrastructure systems across the board. And with that, I am going to hand it over to Mary, and we're going to do our first musical chair. I'm going to switch with Frank from Humphrey, and I'll be back up in a moment. Thanks, all.
Welcome to the committee. If you could please just state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning. I'm Mary Vogel from the Minnesota Design Center, and I'm going to talk to you about some specific work as an example of the kind of work we're talking about. We at the Minnesota Design Center have worked for decades all over the state with communities on projects. And we're going to talk about just one. Our work empowers local communities by responding to locally driven agendas, building on local assets, addressing local problems, connecting to existing funding programs, and positioning projects for competitive funding. We also hire university students from the community to work on the project. In short, we seek more community value from the investments made. The example I'm going to give you is the work we did with Wabasha, part of the work we did with Wabasha on Highway 60. Wabasha is a community of under 5,000 people on the Mississippi River between Red Wing and Winona. State Highway 60 crosses the Mississippi River right by downtown. And there is a ball field with bleachers at the base of its bridgehead. There is a number of issues associated with this bridge and highway. Turning is a safety hazard. There have been a number of vehicles that have come off the bridge and haven't made the 90-degree turn required and hit the ball, the fence and bleachers in the ball field. And the community is concerned that sometime a truck could come off the bridge and kill somebody who's watching the ball game. There's also an issue of seasonal reroute. The bridge passes under a railroad viaduct, and it floods every spring. So they have to reroute the highway through the residential area. And then the third thing was the community wants to relocate the playing field to address the safety issue, but also to consolidate its recreational assets in its recreational center. Now the county, there are two proposals on the table. The county wanted to seek state aid funding to fix the turns by widening the road. It wouldn't change the 90-degree turns, but widening the road. They were seeking hundreds of thousands of dollars for this work. We at the Design Center came up with an alternative proposal. We wanted to reroute a section of Highway 60 to eliminate the dangerous 90-degree turns at the bridgehead, and therefore eliminating the safety hazard. We also would eliminate the residential rerouting during flooding. It also shortens the highway to reduce routine maintenance. It decreases the construction costs by using dredge material. The Mississippi has to be dredged every year to maintain navigation at Wabasha, so they have a lot of dredge material to use. It enhances the local trail system along the waterfront. It develops developable land close to downtown. It strengthens Wabasha's recreational system by relocating its playing field. So in short, our proposal creates more community value for the investment sought. Thank you very much.
All right, and we, as we change the bench again, I'll take over. I'm Frank Dalma, the Director of State and Local Policy and Outreach at the Institute for Urban and Regional Infrastructure Finance at the Humphrey School of Public Affairs. That is all listed on the final slide and I think on the agenda, so you didn't have to catch that all at once. I am here from the Humphrey School, also representing Professor Ryan Allen, who is the Associate Dean for Research at the Humphrey School that has been working with us. And we're very excited about this opportunity. The Humphrey School trains and produces a number of alumni who are very active at all levels of government, including here at the state of Minnesota. And they are engaged in the types of research that I'll talk about in the next few minutes. We have nationally recognized faculty and researchers working in a number of relevant areas to this committee, including energy infrastructure, transportation, environmental impact, housing policy. We're involved with the state serving as advisors to the Green Step program and other state programs. And just here on the map, this is just a snapshot of a number of activities that we're currently involved in the state, whether it's addressing construction mitigation impacts and planning in Alexandria, or innovative transit opportunities in Grand Rapids, where I'm also working with Professor Fisher on some very interesting opportunities that we'd be happy to talk about at another time. We're engaged with the tribal communities on other projects, and would be very, very pleased to continue to build upon that work under this proposal. Another area that we provide is technical expertise and support. We have a project called the Transportation Policy and Economic Competitiveness Program, where we support a transportation finance database. This is just one screen of a number of the pieces of information that are available where we track everything from registered vehicles in Minnesota to the fuel consumption of those vehicles, break it down by driver. We also look at transit, both urban and in greater Minnesota, and the finance revenues and expenditures that travel throughout the state. So we believe that we have a lot of very interesting opportunities. We have a number of connections to other substantive areas in the university where we enjoy the opportunity to bring that back to policy opportunities for implementation. And we're very, very excited when Representative Cagle reached out, and we're pleased that this committee was changed and she was able to chair, and be interested in talking further once we're done. I'll now turn it over to Mr. Kingery.
Hello, I'm Linda Kingery. I am in this position of the interim statewide director for the Regional Sustainable Development Partnerships. Maybe I'll explain the interim first, because this is a program that's strong and in good hands. Kathy Drager is the statewide director, and she's on a professional development leave for 6 months. So that's the reason I'm here in this interim capacity. First, I'll just describe the regional partnerships as the program that we are. This is a program within Extension. So Extension is our home. We are also guided by a council of deans that includes the dean of the Humphrey School for Public Policy, the dean of the College of Design, and the dean of the College of Food, Agriculture, and Natural Resource Sciences. So easy to go to the acronym CFANS, but so we're connected across a number of colleges. Broader than that, when we start thinking about the projects as well. We're organized in five regions that cover all of greater Minnesota, and in each of those regions, there's a staff person, an executive director, working with a board of directors, and a larger network, too, that I'll circle back to. But that's five regions. We organize our work around four focus areas, all within this sustainability the frame of sustainable development. So one of those focus areas is sustainable agriculture and food systems. Another is clean energy. Natural resources is the third, and resilient communities is the fourth. And of course, those are not discrete and disconnected, right? They are way very much overlapping and interconnected. This work seems to fit really well with sort of that resilient communities at the center, and the other pieces adding in. All of the work that the regional partnerships do are founded on some bedrock principles, and that is a partnership between the university and the community. The expectation that relationship is really flat and level. That the community's knowledge and dreams and desires matter as much as the expertise, sort of the disciplinary expertise that comes from the university. Also that these are community-led projects. So this is the community saying, this is the direction that we're interested in. This is our aspiration. And then that they fit within this sustainability framework that values economic and environmental and social capitals in a balanced way as well. I had a couple of examples. Just this all seems really theoretical. When I was serving as the executive director in the Northwest region, that was like from the time my kids were in grade school and high school and on to college, and they said, you have a job that I can never explain to anyone, right? So the examples make it a little more just concrete. Over those, I worked for about 21 years in the Northwest region there, that big area that mostly the land that drains to the Red River. Many, many small communities in that region, of course. A new downtown for Thief River Falls came from the Downtown Development Committee of the Chamber of Thief River Falls. They said there was a housing project to at a local hospital,
the hospital had, that hospital had closed. They built a new one. They were going to be planning housing there, and they wanted their downtown to be a place where much more walkable and much more friendly for those new residents. So the College of Design worked with the community to design what that would mean. Calming traffic a bit in that downtown area, making it easier for pedestrians to cross streets, greening it up a bit so that the greenness from the river corridor was present across town, and taking care of some of the bringing new ideas for some of the vacant properties in town. We have about 100 projects across those five regions. There's about 100 projects open at any time, so we could talk about examples for the rest of the day, but I don't want to derail the conversation to that. So let me just say one more thing about those networks in each of the regions. Has been for most of this 25-year history, one staff person, one support staff that's provided by Extension, but the board of directors and the network of people that are involved in those focus area work groups give each region, a sort of a outreach force of 60 people that really spread across, represent broadly across that region, and are community leaders in their own right, knowing what's being talked about and proposed. So I think we've been able to leverage a lot of volunteer effort. And I will leave it there for now. Thank you very much.
All right, and just to finish up talking a little bit about the Center for Transportation Studies, and I hope all of this reflects just the breadth of the work that our four units do, and again, is just a quick snapshot of across the system, as you all know, what the work the university can do. The Center for Transportation Studies is a system-wide unit. We work with researchers and scholars across all of our campuses. It's an interdisciplinary unit. We work with folks from engineering to policy to design and everything in between. We have large-scale administrative experience, including the running of multiple national transportation research centers, and we support multiple statewide programs, including the Minnesota Towards Zero Death Program and the Local Technical Assistance Program funded by the Federal Highway Administration. And then we've also coordinated several large-scale RFPs within the university, and providing funding across multiple university programs, so have a lot of expertise in helping to distribute funds across our system and to think about how we shape and run those programs. To finish up here, and then love to hear your questions and discuss this a little bit further, just highlighting a little bit about what our proposal would look like and cost. This is broken down by those three circles, basically, and then the overall support. What we have talked about here is about $2.5 to $3 million a year, depending on our final scope and what makes sense from your all's perspective and what our folks are able to do. The Empowering Communities cohort from RCP and MDC, at about $1 million a year, we believe would allow us to engage with about 15 to 20 communities in that really in-depth intensive process. The broader U of M project support, again, this is that access to the deep bench of folks across the system and across disciplines. Again, proposing about $1 million a year there to identify and connect communities with the right folks across the university to help address their questions and opportunities. And then the sort of biggest circle around sustainable infrastructure policy and practice development, anywhere between $200,000 and $500,000 a year, again, depending on what the request or the scope of that work could be. What we've talked about is everything from helping to identify what are the current situations with our various infrastructure systems, what are those current assets, what are the life cycles of those assets, over to thinking about what are we talking about when we're really thinking about a sustainable infrastructure set of policies and how do we plan and prioritize those projects. So again, that's a bit of a window there. And then of course with the administrative general support, again, sort of a $300,000 to $500,000 a year, depending on the final scope. The higher end of that, one thing we wanted to highlight is, as we've been listening to testimony to your committee throughout the session so far, obviously there's a really great need for grant writing support and sort of that helping those communities not just say what is the project, but really get it through the process and do those grant proposals in a way that makes them really competitive. That's that last essential step. You could have a great project, and if your grant proposal doesn't have the right page limit and the right numbers, we all know it doesn't get funded. And so if that were something, the university would be very excited to provide that. It would have to look like full-time folks who are grant writers within the university dedicated to this program. So that is also an expense. So that's the sort of higher end of that bucket. And then in terms of structure, we are open to sort of, as I said at the beginning, where this could fit and how this could fit, and whether it be a larger structure that this committee and others are thinking about within the state, or if it dovetails alongside other existing technical assistance programs. Like I said at the beginning, we see this as a really complementary piece. I would acknowledge that this is certainly not a proposal that would encompass all of the technical assistant needs of our small communities by themselves and townships and others. And obviously there's a range of technical assistance provided to other communities of different sizes. So we're open to talking about where this fits and where the structure would slide in. And then just so you know, and I can talk about this more, within U of M, we would obviously develop our own internal approach to this to ensure the projects and the pieces that we develop here are funded as we discuss, and output is what we are promising to you all. But we'll continue to talk to you about how that works together as well. And with that, I think just these are our names and contacts once more. And then I'm going to try to field questions. I may do a little bit more musical chairs if there's a more detailed question. But thank you for your time, and we'd love to talk some more.
Thank you so much. We have questions. So Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for the presentation. And this would be for either Ms. Kingery or Dr. Shelton. You know, as transportation, I've been on the transportation committee here since forever, and I've had the opportunity to travel around the state and look at the different, you know, infrastructure. And I think it was the summer of 2019. I was up in Crookston and visited with the Tri-Valley Transit folks. Mm. You know, that's one of the rural transit systems. And I was intrigued by the fact that they were running buses up to Thief River Falls because people in Crookston were working at DigiKey. And so I think they ran a couple buses in the morning and then back in the evening. And some of that has to do with the lack of housing and affordable housing. So I was wondering if in your work or in this proposal, there is a transit housing nexus all over the state. You know, whether it's in the metro or in a place like Crookston or Thief River Falls. And so I'm wondering if you have, you know, delved into that and, you know, whether that would be part of any kind of regional sustainable infrastructure, you know, proposal or idea.
Yeah, thanks, Representative. I'm going to pass to Linda if she has an example in a second, but I'd say at a high level would be, yes, the idea of this would be that our definition of infrastructure for this is encompassing many systems, the transportation system being one of those. I would argue that a housing system is an infrastructure system as well, and really thinking about how those are interconnected are exactly the types of projects I think Mary and Linda were both mentioning that we've worked on in the past and are that perfect example of the type of work we'd love to do with communities, is that none of these are isolated. And when you're thinking about how folks are getting to work and where they're going to work, that's just as much about housing as it is about transportation. But Linda, I don't know if you have a specific
example. I would just say there have been at least a half a dozen housing-related projects within the regional partnership system. We have often done projects that are, you know, a semester or a year long, often involve students. And so this sort of more comprehensive look allows a much fuller investigation of those, but definitely we're hearing that housing is the issue almost everywhere we turn.
Representative Hornsey.
And I guess also thank you for that. And I think also, you know, there are certain areas in greater Minnesota that I think, you know, people question sometimes, well, you know, the distances are far and it's a whole different situation with transit. Yeah. In greater Minnesota. But, you know, this example I gave, and I think there's many others around mm-hmm. the state, I think just an examination of transit, mm-hmm. You know, both within communities and then between communities in greater Minnesota would be extremely helpful. And, mm-hmm. and you know, we hope to, you know, we're examining that in the Transportation Committee. And we think a robust funding for greater Minnesota transit is in order. But I think that, you know, come up with some very specific examples of that would be very helpful.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would just highlight as well, and we can follow up with either Professor Fisher or Mr. Dama. There are a number of pilot projects going on right now, both inter and intra-city, with both connected and autonomous vehicles and then other approaches to rural transit. So it's a great idea. Yeah.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of questions. In your literature, you talk about smaller communities and then small communities. I haven't seen a number. What do you consider small? 5,000, 500, 10,000? Who's your target here?
Yeah, I think that's
Dr. Shelton.
I think that's a great question. Thank you. I would say that's another example of something that we'd be happy to talk with the committee and define if there are particular thresholds you all would talk about. There's a couple different definitions, whether you want to take the Census Bureau's definition. Most are defined under 10,000. But I think our goal would be to really be, if we want to define a particular number, we can. Our goal would be to really identify and think about this project serving those communities that are just at that capacity limitation, where they're not able, whether it's a township, a small city, or, I mean, you even think about some of the smaller counties. What are the ways that a program like this can help provide that bandwidth and capacity? So happy to define that. I think using some of the census-designated thresholds typically makes sense, because that's where a lot of those communities access other funding and formula projects. But at the moment, we haven't decided a single number.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And if you were able to get some of the funding you're talking about here, would you envision this to be provided to these smaller communities free of charge or on some kind of a cost share basis?
No, the goal of this program would be that the funding coming from the state is allowing the university to go to those communities to partner with them at no additional cost. That the proposal here is what would allow us to do that.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks. Thank you. I had a question for the fellow from the Humphrey School, and I think if I heard him correctly, he talked about being able to track the miles driven by individual cars. How are you doing that?
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, thank you for that question. If I implied we were tracking individual cars, that is not what we're doing. It's far beyond the capacity even of the university. But what we do is we are able to track the data collected about overall vehicle miles traveled, which is reported through a number of different sources. And then that just gives an information on how much our infrastructure is being used and financed and so forth.
Representative Anderson. Representative Gilman.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I had a quick question about the Wabasha project. If you wouldn't mind hopping up, is it Ms. Vogel?
Yes,
awesome. I've traveled that corridor on my motorcycle. I know what corner you're talking about, and I didn't launch my bike over the edge. But I do know where you're talking about. So real quick, I'm just trying to understand how, when you guys partner with cities and counties and bring these cool projects to be, did the county go like a less more conservative route because of, you know, finances, or did they kind of like bullet point out what they did? It was a couple $100,000, and I just was curious how much the proposed project would be. Would that be included in the last sheet that we just went through?
Yeah.
For example,
Ms.
thank
Bowman.
You.
Madam Chair, Representative. I do not have the numbers for the projected cost for our design. Things have been changing a lot. We made this recommendation about 2.5 years ago.
Wow.
And so things are different.
Yeah.
We were able to partner with Wabasha very well. One of the reasons was that small community, it's fun to work with small communities. The people are great. And the president of the city council was a former, he's a civil engineer. He used to work for MnDOT. He used to be the county engineer. So we were able to partner with him and create a design that made sense. Mm-hmm. and that he was very excited about it. He said he's wanted this to happen for 30 years. I hope that answers your question.
Real quick. So I don't think the part about what I was wondering about is when we do projects on the back page, when it's talking about the funding source, is that just for like vetting it and then the project is a separate cost on top of it?
Correct. So what this would really be doing is using state money to leverage the federal funding. And so making sure that we have the best possible grant applications, RFPs, and that the university is really, for lack of a better term, holding the hands of small communities through the process. And so that we're meeting the goals of the, you know, a lot of these grants have specific policy goals in mind. And so how do we make sure that our communities are getting their fair share mm-hmm. of it, and that we're making sure that our proposals are as strong as possible for that competing money? If that makes sense.
Yep. Okay. Yep. Thank you.
Any follow-up?
Nope. That's all I had.
Representative Ream.
Thank you, Chair Cagle. So this is a question, I think, for Dr. Kyle Shelton. You mentioned the Towards Zero Deaths project, and we're often talking about making our cities more walkable and bikeable. Can you talk a little bit more about how we're making them safer? Because I know a lot of people are transitioning away from cars, and I know this people speeding on the roads has gone up too. Is there something that you are working on to help make our community safer in that regard?
Yeah, and I think that this proposal is a great example of how you could incorporate questions around road safety for all users in any of these communities, right? I think the example that Mary's giving in Wabasha is a good version of that. Just briefly, the Minnesota Towards Zero Death program is a collaboration between three state agencies, public safety, health, and MnDOT, and the Center for Transportation Studies is a logistical partner on that. And that effort is statewide. It is complemented by Vision Zero coordinators in many communities. Like RSDP, it has regional coordinators across the state working with law enforcement and communities to try to improve everything from individual behavior to the infrastructure that supports safety. And I think this proposal, certainly if communities are saying one of our issues is wanting to ensure that folks walking and biking within a small town or to the different destinations within the community, driving or taking transit between their destinations, all have a safe and comfortable way to do that, is certainly within the bounds of these projects. And I think that would be where we would really want to work with the community to identify, is there a specific location or a specific intersection that you're really concerned about where you're seeing lots of crashes or safety concerns, and what would be the right set of responses, right? Because in most contexts, it may not just be a design or infrastructure question. There may be some other elements that you want to add in there to think about how you ensure folks are moving through and in a place safely.
Representative Ream?
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Mm-hmm. It reminds me a little bit of our field hearing that we had in the North Metro for transportation. I suppose Representative Hornstein was the only one that was there. but we went up there, and there's an intersection right by my house where there's a huge transit station. And the transit station is not connected to the crosswalk. And so people would be using cow paths to get up and drag their groceries up over the bench or the snowbanks. And we were actually standing on the corner out there watching this woman with all of our committee. And so some of the changes that we made, there was a lot of fatalities at that intersection, striping, increased lighting, and a sidewalk. And those were just some really easy changes that we could make that increased the safety there, that didn't cost the state a heck of a lot. And then we have a long-term plan too to kind of start addressing a lot of those safety issues. So it was a really cool process. And I always apologize to my MnDOT people that I'm so annoying, but you know, that's how you get stuff done. So.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hornstein.
Well, I think there's also, we also saw a transit shelter on basically what would be the equivalent of a freeway shoulder. And no real way to get there, safe way to get there. So, you know, these things are all over the state and need to be addressed and corrected.
Yeah. So, and I really think, you know, the goal of this is really to have this as a collaborative process where, you know, us as a committee are building this up, but then also communities are the ones that are driving the projects and driving, you know, what their community is going to look like with a little help from us. So any other further questions to our testifiers? If not, I very much appreciate it. Thank you so much. We will be continuing these conversations, and I encourage any member of the committee to reach out to these folks because they have been wonderful. So I very much appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So next on the agenda is, let me find my agenda. We are going to have a presentation from the Insurance Federation on the impact of extreme weather events on the business of insurance. So a copy of that PowerPoint is in your agenda, or is in your packet as well. And Mr. Kudla?
Kolda.
Kolda.
Yes.
Will be our presenter. So welcome to the committee. State your name for the record again and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you much, Madam Chair. My name is Mark Kolda. I'm the Vice President of Public Affairs at the Insurance Federation of Minnesota. The IFM, just for background, is a nonprofit state insurance trade association. We've been around since 1914. We represent property casualty insurers. And so for purposes of this discussion, that means we represent homeowners and commercial property insurance carriers. We are not climate experts, but we're here to talk about what we are experts in, and that is data science. We're numbers people, so we have the numbers to show you what is happening. We can't say why it's happening, but we can definitely define what is happening. We're very good at numbers, and we'll go through a bunch of numbers in this presentation. The first number, it was just stability. We've had a long history of stability in Minnesota, dating back to the mid-1900s. We saw literally decades of weather and property claim stability, and then all of a sudden it changed, literally in 1 year. That year was 1998. The very first storm that took our attention was the March 29th, 1998 storm. There was an outbreak of tornadoes that hit Le Centre, devastated Comfrey in St. Peter. You might remember the iconic picture from that storm is that Gustavus Adolphus had toppled the steeple, and that was the picture that was in everybody's memory back then. But then a couple weeks later, we had a large outbreak of tornadoes and storms that on May 15th, 1998, not only was devastating in terms of tornadoes, but that was also a very large hailstorm that hit the Twin Cities metro area right at rush hour. So not only did we have a whole bunch of property insurance claims, but because everybody was on the road at the time the hailstorm hit, we had a very large number of auto claims as well. And that storm cost $950 million in insured losses. It was the most expensive storm in state history. And get used to that phrase, because I'm going to say that a couple times here, right? And then skip ahead a few more weeks. We were part of a very large storm called the Southern Great Lakes Derecho. It wasn't necessarily damaging here in Minnesota as much as it was the rest of the upper Midwest. But it was one of the three main storms that we had that year. And when you added all the losses together in 1998, we had $1.5 billion in catastrophe losses. And the reason why that's so important and noteworthy is because that $1.5 billion is more than the previous 40 years combined. So we had decades of storm losses concentrated in 1 year, and it really didn't stop. Back in 1998, our average homeowner's insurance premium was $368 per year. That was well below the national average of $455 per year. But then in the last 25 years, we've seen just an alarming weather trends. We're seeing more storms. The storms that we're seeing are stronger. They're more severe storms. And instead of one-off storms, they're happening as part of large outbreaks, and it's getting more expensive. So then we go through some of the recent catastrophe history, because for about 10 years, it was relatively quiet. And then in 2007, we had another $750 million in insured losses. We were the second highest catastrophe state in the country, second only to California, which had wildfires that year. Then the next year, 2008, we had $1.5 billion in losses again. So here, 40 years of combined losses, we had $1.5 billion in 98. Then 10 years later, we have another $1.5 billion in losses. We were the third highest catastrophe loss state in the country that year, third only to Texas and Louisiana, which had hurricanes. And then in 2010, we had our worst year ever. We average typically in Minnesota about 44 tornado touchdowns per year. In 2010, we led the nation in tornado touchdowns. We had 144 tornado touchdowns in 2010. That's more than Texas. And so we even saw a storm up in Wadena where we saw one building was $60 million loss. One of our member companies had to pay to replace the high school in Wadena. And when you do the math on $1.5 billion over 40 years, you realize that that one building was more than an entire year across the entire state prior to 1998. And then here in one storm, one building, we had a whole year's worth of losses in 2010. It was our worst year ever. In 2011, we only had 30 tornadoes, so we swung back to below our average. But one tornado happened to hit the most densely populated area of the state. That was North Minneapolis. That could have been a very expensive storm. It was only $250 million, but if you remember 2010, that was right during the middle of the mortgage crisis. So there was an awful lot of uninsured properties. So the loss was a lot higher in North Minneapolis, but the insured loss was only $250 million. Then on July 1st, there was a devastating storm that struck southwest Minnesota. I know because I was driving through it. I was on 212 going west. I almost got to Bird Island, and the storm hit. It was one of the worst storms that I've ever seen before. The airport in Olivia had a 90-mile-per-hour sustained wind for almost 45 minutes, and that's about the same as a Category 2 hurricane. So here we talk about how we're not a hurricane state, but I like to say Mother Nature treats us like one because it's going to get worse. In 2010, it's not just the hail and the tornadoes and the wind. We're seeing increasingly amounts of heavy rain activity. And in 2012, you might remember, there was heavy rain in Duluth. The zoo was heavily affected there. There was $450 million in reconstruction costs. Most of that was public infrastructure that had to be rebuilt. You skip ahead to 2013. We had a record low number of tornadoes. So now here we go, just from 2010, the record high number of tornadoes, till we swing to the opposite end of that. We had a record low number of tornadoes, but we had other types of storms. We had a big winter ice storm that year. In late June here in St. Paul, we were hit by a pretty strong storm that knocked out power. We had the largest power outage we've ever had that June. There was the most number of people without power for the longest amount of time. It was our largest power outage ever. And then in August, there was a very large hailstorm that cost $900 million, another almost billion-dollar loss. We would have been the number one state that year, except late in the year there was a tornado in Peoria that knocked us down to number four. In 2015, skip ahead, we had the Brainerd Lakes area hailstorm. That was about $250 million in insured losses. Skip ahead again to the June 11, 2017 storm. There was a small hailstorm that struck Brooklyn Park and Coon Rapids. I know Representative Stevenson isn't on this committee, but if you talk to him, he'll tell you that was a really bad storm. It was a small area, though. Brooklyn Park, Coon Rapids, it was devastating for those communities. We estimated initially that there would be about $900 million in losses, but it takes 2 years to get your insurance claims filed. You have 2 years to file the claim, and so insurers have to kind of spend 2 years paying the claims. A year after the storm, the number was up to $1.5 billion. 2 years after the storm, it ended up being a $3.2 billion hailstorm for just Brooklyn Park and Coon Rapids. It's the most expensive storm in state history by far, and it was the 10th most expensive storm in the world that year for insured losses. Just a little 20-minute hailstorm in Brooklyn Park and Coon Rapids, $3.2 billion. Skip ahead to what was probably the weirdest weather day in Minnesota, December 15th of 2021. This is the middle of December. It started as a typical December day. The temperatures, though, zoomed up to almost 70 degrees in southern Minnesota, and we had a very large derecho that generated over Minnesota caused something that we'd never seen before. In over 150 years of recorded Minnesota history, we have not ever seen a tornado touchdown in the month of December, and on December 15th, there were 16 tornadoes that touched down all throughout southern Minnesota. And then typical Minnesota, once the derecho moved through, we had a 50-degree temperature drop and a blizzard. So here we started with 70-degree temperatures in the morning. We ended up with blizzard-like conditions, blowing snow, temperatures below freezing, et cetera. And then if one derecho wasn't enough on December 15th, 6 months later, we had a second derecho. So here you go from decades of stability to a derecho, and then all of a sudden two derechos in 6 months. May 12th in western Minnesota, we had hurricane-force winds. I talked about the 90-mile-an-hour wind in Olivia back in earlier in the decade, but we had 110-mile-an-hour wind gust in the city of Madison that day. There were two fatalities. A storm chaser from Peru was killed in a car crash along Interstate 90 on that day, and then an on-duty volunteer firefighter who was called out on storm watch duty was leaving his farm, and the wind hit, and the silo collapsed on top of his car, and sadly, he was killed in the line of duty. But temperature extremes. That week, in May 12th, we saw the season's first 70-degree, first 80-degree, and first 90-degree of the season all in 1 week. So just terribly unusual temperature extremes, and we're starting to see that. And then Memorial Day of 2022, we had another outbreak of tornadoes, 8 tornadoes. One hit south of Alexandria. That destroyed about 100 homes and businesses. One of the tornado tracks was 50 miles long. We're starting to see not just one-off storms. These are incredibly destructive and intense storms. And Minnesota led the nation in hail and wind events in May. So it's not just tornadoes and wind damage and hail, though, that we're seeing. We're seeing extreme downpours. Flash flooding is a problem. Because we are Minnesota, and this is going to be another bad year for snow load, we already know that there have been a couple of commercial buildings that have collapsed this year because of snow load. Ice dams are terrible this year. It's a terrible year for ice dams. But we're also a state that we have a history of wildfires, and we have to be ready for that. So we are a state that is affected by wind-driven wildfires as yet another weather peril that's facing us. Back in 2020, the National Center for Environmental Information decided to put the statistics together and determined which states have the most extreme weather, and you see in the packet, we are the state with the second most extreme weather next to California. So it's something that's getting expensive for us, because back in 1998, our average homeowner's insurance premium was $368 a year. Now it's $1,433. That's almost a 400% increase just in the last two decades. We went from being a cheap state. We used to be well below the national average. The national average back in 1998 was $455, so we were well below the national average. Now at $1,433, we are well above the national average, which is only $1,272. Back in 1998, we were the 35th state in the country for the in terms of highest insurance premiums, so we were a lower third, low-cost state. Now at $1,433, we are now the 14th most expensive state in the country to buy homeowners insurance, and we are only a few dollars away from being a top 10 premium state, and we don't really want to be there. Why are the premiums becoming more expensive? It's not just more storms, but the building materials, because of the supply chain issues, they cost more. You know, the contractors that fix homes, they have the same labor issues that everybody else has, so the labor costs are going up, so the cost to repair homes is becoming much more expensive. The storm chaser problem is a problem, so anytime there is a storm in the area, you'll see lots of storm chasers in the area, and I will tell you that when they fix a house, it's a lot more expensive than the contractors that are from Minnesota, so that's something that we have to pay for. But the insurance industry does do a few things, and in the last slide I talk a little bit about that. We have increased the use of reinsurance, so premiums are held a little bit lower than they would be because insurers use the tool of reinsurance to help manage and mitigate the risk. But we do things like we support stricter building codes. Insurers will give you premium discounts if when you're rebuilding your home or building your home, you fit them with things like sprinklers or resilient materials. Like, for example, if you get you can get some code, you can get some hail-resistant shingles. They're called Class 5 shingles. If you replace your roof with those shingles, usually your insurer will give you a premium discount. And the insurance industry supports an organization called the IIBHS. That stands for Insurance Institute for Business and Home Safety. I strongly encourage you to go to their website, IBHS.org. They have some really interesting videos. They have a facility in South Carolina where they have a large structure where they can subject buildings to extreme weather events. So they have this interesting, lab inside that building where they can build two buildings, one to the older codes and one to the more resilient codes, and then subject both of those buildings to strong winds and wind-driven hail and wind-driven rain. And you can watch the video. The older buildings will just get blown away by the wind, and the newer, more resilient buildings will still be standing. And then they can compare what the cost is of building those two buildings, and you can see just is it worth it or not. It's a really interesting set of videos at IBHS.org to go check out. So thank you, Madam Chair. That's a much abbreviated version of this presentation. I usually take about 20 minutes, so I'm sorry for going so fast, but I would be glad to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you so much. I have a quick question. Yes. So with the industry efforts, the premium discount for resilient materials, do you find a lot of people taking advantage of that? I just think about the upfront cost of a lot of these materials. And so when the claims are being paid out, you know, the homeowners are going to end up being the ones to really eat the cost of that. Is there any thought on maybe investing a little upfront and paying out higher claims so that you won't have to do it in the future?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, for that question. What I'd say is that normally an insurance company is paying a pretty large amount of money to start the process. So the most of the money in the rebuilding is going to be the actual rebuilding. So you'll have a good chunk of money from your policy payout to begin with, and then the policy only holder only has to kick in a little extra to build extra. You know, the return on that is a long return because the premium discount is over many years. So it's a little harder to pay the money up front. You will eventually get it back over the years that you spread out your payments and then get that discount to kind of pay toward that, I'd say. Yeah. But generally, you're going to have a large chunk of money from your policy payout anyway.
Representative Gilman.
Awesome. Thank you, Madam Chair. So quick question. So it's Mark, right?
Yes.
Okay, sweet. I was just thinking about the storm. How long was the record power outage? How, like, was it days, hours? How long was that storm back in 2013? I was just curious.
Mr. Coble?
Madam Chair, Representative Gilman, that one was several days long. I don't remember the exact number of hours, but, like power outages, the power returns in phases.
Yep.
And so initially, I'm sure they were able to turn the power back on, but there was a large chunk of people, and I think they were pretty much concentrated in really the St. Paul area, they were out for days and days. So it was a very long power outage. That also leads to another claim that you could have. So if your home wasn't really damaged, but you had the power outage, oftentimes, for example, the food in your refrigerator might spoil. You might have some other losses related to the power outage. And subject to your deductible, you might be able to have an insurance claim on that. But those would be covered losses in that event.
And just a follow-up question. So are you concerned about just, you know, our energy situation that we have coming forward with but the possibility of more rolling blackouts, depending upon the season? It could be summer, spring, winter. You know, the food piece is what I'm thinking about. I'm thinking of our grocers. I'm thinking about farmers, people. They're, you know, losing. I've lost before when a sweet child of mine has left a freezer open, and I've got... sweet child of mine. It's a good song too.
Music can start playing.
You know, and that the investment that we put into buying, you know, the food in there, it was significant. So I just wondered if the insurance companies are concerned about rolling blackouts and the impact that would have, in not only bringing us to the 14th most highest in premiums, but could bring us up to number one, potentially.
Mr. Cole?
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Gilman, yes, we are concerned about that. I mean, the power outage doesn't have to be triggered by a storm. It just has to be a power outage. So if you have a power outage, whether it's storm-related or whatever, there could be additional covered claims by that. So to the extent that there could be, we would be concerned because every time we have to pay a claim, that means that you end up paying for it in higher premiums.
Yes. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thanks. Yep, thank you. And I think that Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, a few things just for anybody's interest. I was kind of doing some searching of some of the worst storms that we've had in Minnesota history, and the DNR has a nice listing of the famous winter storm. So I found that very fascinating. Going back to 1835 as the first severe storm, and then we had talking about the tornadoes, then we also have the DNR has a Minnesota Tornado History and Statistics page. So very fascinating. I assume that's where you got your data from, was that page. So I hope that for climate change purposes that this is accurate information and not skewed to an agenda. But we're talking about weather today, climate. So I'm, Madam Chair, I'm still a little confused here because last week I was told we were not to talk about climate because this is not the climate change committee. This is a sustainable infrastructure. Now I understand how weather-related events can affect sustainable or affect infrastructure, but would really like to have a committee that, if we are going to talk about infrastructure, deals just with infrastructure and not have more presentations on climate. But since Mr. Kolda is here, would you mind, I have some questions regarding your impact on the homeowners' rates.
Sure.
So I found that interesting. I think back in the day, it was about $3 to $4 per $1,000 of home price. Do you know what that updated price would be for 2023?
Mr. Kolda?
Madam Chair, Representative Franzen, I don't think we calculate it in those sort of terms per dollar per $1,000. You know, usually it's based on the value of the home and then what the expected cost would be to, for example, replace the home and other perils. It's not just storm-related. It could be burglary losses, fire loss, et cetera. So there's a number of perils that we try to anticipate happening and what the rebuilding cost would be, and then that's factored into what your premium would be.
Madam Chair.
Quickly, we have a couple more folks on the list, and then we do have a bill up, too. So go ahead, Representative Franzen.
Okay, so does the cost, okay, so the Minneapolis Area Association of Realtors, their annual data, in 1998, the average sale price was $147,346. 2022, in that same area, the average price of homes is now at $424,836. And then according to the Redfin, the average price in Minnesota in 2022 was about $315,000. Now, does that price of home also affect the increase of what we're seeing in 1998 of $368 for homeowners premium to the 2019, not quite 2022, of 1433.
Mr. Kolda?
So, Madam Chair, Representative Franzen, you are correct that one of the biggest reasons why the premium is that high is because it is more expensive to not only build but to rebuild the home, too. So, and in the presentation, back in 1998, the trend for homeowners' increases was generally, you know, the increased cost of the homes. Now it seems to be more driven by the fact that the homes are getting struck by more weather. So we're having to pay a lot more, instead of rebuilding costs, just more repair costs to fix homes, replace roofs. Really, the really big driver is hail and roofs right now. So the reason why we're paying such high premiums is because we're seeing more hail and we're having to replace more roofs, and replacing a roof is a lot more expensive now than it was 20 years ago.
Okay.
So then just one comment, and this is just to the body. So the UN Office for Disaster Risk Reduction, definitely not a fake news website, right? It's the UN. Their reporting says the number of weather-related events has declined. And so I'm confused. If it's declining, according to the UN and the Center for Research on the Epidemiology of Disasters, what is happening then in Minnesota, where we are going up, but reporting worldwide says that weather-related incidences are on the downtrend? I just find that very curious. Do you have any ideas for that?
Mr. Kolder?
Madam Chair, Representative Franzen, you know, a number from the UN is probably a large global number.
Right.
What we can talk about is the statistics that we get from our member companies based on claims here in Minnesota. And the numbers are that we are seeing a lot more storms and a lot more storm claims, which is why our premiums have gone up so high. So you have to remember also that around the world, we're one of the few countries where we actually have widespread insurance. There's a lot of damage worldwide that's not even covered by insurance. So we are talking here about what the claims are here in Minnesota. So the reason why our numbers are so high is because we are seeing more storms, and that is leading to more claims.
Well, I'm talking to you, Madam Chair, about the
We have a lot of folks on
storms,
the list. So,
not actually and, claims, though.
Yeah, we have a lot of folks on the list. Representative Smith?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. Is it Mr. Kolda?
Kolda, yes.
Kolda, sorry mm-hmm. about that. So I appreciate at the beginning you said you're a data person. I'm going to try to focus in on data questions, not mm-hmm. asking you to interpret them.
Sure.
So I have a series of questions just to kind of coalesce, I think, what you've brought us here today. So would you think it's accurate to portray the data as saying since 1998, where you started your presentation, extreme weather and payouts because of extreme weather has increased in the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Kolda?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, absolutely yes. That's the numbers are the numbers, and the numbers that we get, we don't get them from the DNR. These are numbers from our member companies. So it's the data that's reported to us that we turn out in presentations like this.
Representative Smith?
Wonderful. And my second question is, again, just based on data, I'm not asking you to mm-hmm. predict anything, mm-hmm. but the trend, do you expect that to continue in years to come, or are you able to see a tap out in that data or anything along those lines?
Right.
Mr. Kolda.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, great question. One of the things that insurance companies do now is they do hire not only actuaries to help determine what the price should be, but increasingly not only insurers but reinsurers are starting to hire folks like climatologists and meteorologists to try to figure out what the prediction should be, because one of the tools that the insurance industry uses to keep premiums lower is they buy reinsurance. So reinsurance companies are now on the hook for these major storms. When you see, for example, the Hurricane Ian that went through earlier, within the last 6 months or so in Florida, that's going to be probably $60 or $70 billion in losses, almost all of it on reinsurers. So the folks in Florida aren't having to pay as much to repair the homes as they would have had to without reinsurance. And so your question is about prediction and what do we see? The insurers are seeing that these storms are happening more frequently, so I would say the prediction is that we are going to see this happening in larger and larger scales because that's what the trend has been.
Okay. And then just one final question, Madam.
Quickly, please, yes.
And just finally, because of that potential increase, we hope it doesn't happen, but again, based on the data, if that is going to happen, we've seen in your presentation that premiums, cost of home ownership is going up because of these things. Mm-hmm. Would you anticipate Minnesotans, if this continues, having to pay higher premiums because of that change in weather pattern?
Mr. Kolda?
Right. Madam Chair, Representative Smith, absolutely. They would, for sure.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple comments, and I will have one question as well. So, number one, in Minnesota, we want to celebrate diversity, but I'm hearing that we don't want to celebrate the diversity of our weather, except for Mr. Kolda. I just have to appreciate you seem to have a real passion for it. So credit to you there, and I do hope that within the insurance business that it has been good for you over the last 20 years. But more specifically, I have more good news. Just yesterday, the governor signed a bill that's going to eradicate these huge changes in weather and climate in House File 7. So that's good. So we've got that taken care of. So maybe in sustainable infrastructure, maybe we don't even need this anymore. We've got it taken care of. So that's good. But to Mr. Kolda, could you explain to us, do the products exist in the marketplace today for homeowners, for businesses, for those that you insure mm-hmm. to basically have their infrastructure, their businesses, their homes secured from these large weather events? And if they don't exist today, what kind of research or additional investment needs to be made to ensure that we have the products that can sustain through these large and diverse weather patterns?
Mr. Kolda.
Thank you, Chair and Representative Schultz. I will say that the products exist today because if you do have a storm-related loss, the policy is pretty clear that it covers storm-related losses. What we do see in states where we don't get a handle on costs, though, is oftentimes insurers will take different types of underwriting actions to do things like, for example, in hurricane states, they might adopt a hurricane deductible. So now the policyholder would have to shoulder more risk by paying a higher deductible than what's normal in the policy. You could see cases of insurers leaving the marketplace, which is what has happened in places like Louisiana and Florida. In fact, the Florida property insurance market is pretty much evaporating in front of our very eyes. Last year, I think 6 or maybe even 7 companies went out of business there in Florida. So if we continue to see increasing costs that we can't manage very well, we might see those kind of products go away. They exist now, but they might go away, and we're worried about that.
Representative Schultz, any follow-up? Yep. All right, next on the list is Representative Ream.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for this presentation. It's really interesting. So my question is a bit of a piggyback off of Representative Smith's question. Sure. I'm curious about projections into the future. You talked a lot about, the history and how basically insurance rates have tripled since, what, 1998? Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit more about what the projections are and what factors into it? I know you have the actuaries and you have the climatologists working on it. Right. Are other things a factor, like how many people are, you know, making their homes more resilient, or, you know, those kind of factors? Do those factor in?
Mr. Holder?
Yep, Madam Chair, Representative Ream. The factors that go into a homeowner's insurance premium are pretty diverse. And so claims costs is one of those costs. And so the actuaries work on predicting what the expense is going to be. I think the question is, what is going to happen to future premiums? I know that in even this year, the ask by insurers for price hikes is continuing to the point where it's going to be a very large increase for this year, because, again, we've had a couple companies that said that this last year was their worst year ever. So we're continuing to see the worst year ever for claims, and that means that is probably going to be one of the most important factors driving these costs. To the extent that we could see more people rebuilding their homes in a way that is less likely to lead to claims, that would lower the cost for folks. But I don't think we're there yet. You know, what we see the trend being instead is that we get hit by a storm, the storm chasers come in, the price that they ask to fix homes is way higher than it typically is, and so then we have to pay those excessive costs. And if we can get a handle on those costs, that would be the low-hanging fruit, and then we can talk more about what are ways to help alleviate those increases in the future.
Thank you. We have Representative Kraft, if that's okay. We are way over time on this presentation, and I know Representative Lee has been waiting patiently. Yes. So quickly, Representative Kraft, and then we will move on to House File 1135.
Great. Thank you, Chair Cagle. So, Mr. Kolda, do you have a climate agenda?
Mr. Kolda.
Madam Chair, Representative Kraft, we do not have an agenda for that, no. We are concerned about the increasing amount of storms that are costing us in claims, and anytime we have to pay higher claims, that means you have to pay higher premiums, and the more expensive it gets, the fewer people buy. Homeowners insurance is not a mandated coverage like auto insurance, for example, so the more expensive we have to make coverage, then more and more people drop the coverage, and we don't like that. We would prefer to have the coverage be cheaper so that we could sell it more. That's how we make more money. We make more money by selling cheaper insurance because we can sell more of it.
Right. Thank you. So I have a couple other quick comments.
Quickly, thank you, Representative.
So there was a comment made about the United Nations, and Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, right? This is, I don't know where it was found there, but says, it is an established fact that human-induced greenhouse gas emissions have led to an increased frequency and or intensity of some weather and climate extremes since pre-industrial times. And that is what we're seeing. These are what the scientists say, and these are the facts. Let's deal with the facts. And the other thing I have to say is celebrating weather diversity.
Madam Speaker.
Behind all of those claims are real trauma and losses of people in our state. Mm-hmm. And so I don't want to celebrate that. I want to figure out how we adapt to that and then how we mitigate that going forward.
And I think, thank you, Representative Kraft. I think that's the goal of this committee, is adapting and mitigating and
moving
forward.
Living in, Minnesota has been a state with extreme weather for how long? So do you not think that we have already adapted to weather here? It's not that we can't control the weather here in Minnesota.
Thank you very
much for your
comments.
We can't control it. We cannot control weather.
Thank you very much for your comments. Thank you very much for your presentation, and I appreciate it. Representative Lee, we will now move House File 1135 to the Climate and Energy Policy. I will move that House File 1135 be re-referred to the Climate and Energy Finance and Policy Committee. Representative Lee, I understand you brought the DE2 amendment. I will move your DE2 amendment for, would you like to explain that, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The DE2 amendment adds how future weather trends can be integrated into the design and evaluation of buildings, and how future weather trends may impact our natural systems and the need for infrastructure to maintain and increase our food and wood production. Reduction of fire risk on forested land, maintain and enhance our water quality, and maintain and enhance our natural habitats.
Thank you. So I will move adoption of the DE2 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Motion prevails. All right, now we have House File 1135 as amended before us. Representative Lee, please proceed with your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I do have two testifiers here from the University of Minnesota, and so I will briefly explain why I'm bringing this forward. You know, I have served on the Capital Investment Committee for the last 5 years now, and, you know, ever since that time, when we go out and tour the entire state of Minnesota, you see the impact that extreme weathers have had on our infrastructure, whether that's, you know, natural systems for flood hazard mitigation, or actually looking at, you know, some of our, you know, buildings. And so that really makes me think, you know, how much have we spent on some of these infrastructure projects that's, you know, relating to, you know, increased rainfall, increased flooding. You know, for example, what I always talk about, you know, in the Red River Basin alone from 1997 to 2018, the state of Minnesota has given out a total of around $368 million for flood hazard mitigation. And this year, the Red River Basin is coming back to ask for $73 million. That's about 20% of the total that was spent in that area from 1997 to 2018. And so I think that, you know, we really need to look at how does extreme weather really impact our infrastructure so that we can make a smart and sound fiscal decision as we plan our capital budget. And with that, Madam Chair, I'll turn it over to the two testifiers.
Welcome to the committee. Professor Richard Graves and Dr. Jessica Hellman would like to come up and testify. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, and thank you, Representative Lee, author of this bill, for inviting us here today. My name is Jessica Hellman. I'm the director of the Institute on the Environment and a professor in the College of Biological Sciences at the University of Minnesota. My colleague Richard Graves and I are here to talk about changing climate in our state and about how research could help us make smart investments and in our infrastructure and smarter operations of that infrastructure under a dynamic and changing future. And given that this is our area of expertise and we think about these financial components and operational pieces, we really applaud your desire to understand the changes affecting our public infrastructure and your commitment to stewarding buildings, energy, water, and other assets into the future. So Minnesota's climate is already changing, and it will continue to do so for the foreseeable future. In this graphic from the Minnesota DNR depicts some of the qualities of a changing climate in Minnesota. Temperatures are already increasing, particularly to date in the winter and at night, and larger, more frequent precipitation events and storms are occurring, as we just heard, and also winter is getting shorter. Warming and heavy downpours are affecting our natural resources, agricultural lands, and our cities. And in the decades ahead, we expect to see this warming trend continuing, with more temperature increases appearing increasingly in the summer and during the daytime, and also bringing dry spells and heat waves. For example, this graphic shows historic annual precipitation in Minnesota. And there's a lot of variability in our weather, but the blue line shows an upward trend since, in this graph, 1895, such that we have 3.5 inches more rainfall or snow per year now than we did 100 years ago. And this trend will continue into the future, and the upward line will steepen if climate change proceeds unabated. In addition to precipitation, Minnesota has warmed an average of 5 degrees Fahrenheit, with the warmest and wettest years occurring in recent decades. All but 2 years since 1970 have been warmer, wetter, or both warmer and wetter than the historic average. And all of the 10 warmest and wettest years on record have occurred recently, between 1998 and 2020. The shape and pace of this trend moving forward depends on greenhouse gas emissions, but some of that change is already locked into the system, the changes we have experienced so far. This is the new climate that we live with and that we need to manage our systems, our built and natural environment within. So I'd like to pass to my colleague, Professor Richard Graves, who will talk about the challenges that these climatic changes present to our built environment.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Graves.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the question is, you know, not whether the climate's changing, how it's changing, but I think for this committee, the challenge is, given those changes, what's the impact on infrastructure and how can we design infrastructure in a smarter, more thoughtful, more cost-effective way? So one of the, I'll talk of two examples that we would like to research further, you know, with this bill. One is historically design for site water and road design has focused more on riverine flooding for severe events and moderate rainfall flooding. As we can see in this map from the Met Council, given the increased precipitation, both on average but also in localized flooding, more and more localized flood events or flood sheds when we have these high rain events are just as significant, and we need to be designing around as we continue to think about increased riverine flooding in the future. And this infrastructure operates at a variety of scales, from buildings to roads to lots to neighborhoods to cities to watersheds. So it's not only a road design challenge to design roadways to deal with these you know, heavy rainfall events, but also when it comes to capital construction, how are the sites of capital construction projects designed to absorb higher rain events and mitigate some of this flooding and also reduce the impact on some of the state-funded funded infrastructure. In addition, my center did a study for MPCA in 2018 where we looked at, given future weather, future weather patterns, and we used future weather predictions from a group in the UK called WeatherShift. And the challenge in building design is right now, building designers, architects, engineers, when they're designing a building, we will use historic weather files. And these weather files, at best, are 10 to 15 years old and look 10, 15 years into the past to determine what are the design intent for building projects. However, you know, when you look at these forward predicted models of weather files, they seem to predict closer to what some of the weather patterns might be that we need to be integrating into building design. So you might say, who cares? Why does this even matter? And so what we saw in some of this study is in the downscale data from the UK for Minnesota, that what we saw as a pattern was increased heating in the summers, which required some buildings to consider sun shading to avoid cooling costs that we've never really had to do in Minnesota historically. So that's a design strategy that's becoming potentially needed to be integrated into projects. And then an increased emphasis in cooling and dehumidification systems and mechanical systems to deal with those potential new weather events. So we believe, you know, that's important not only to address the changes, but also so building designers designing for capital construction can develop more cost-effective designs and not be wasting money on strategies that are the strategies of the historic weather event and be investing in strategies about our future challenges. So, you know, the research that's needed is really to think about applying new and emerging downscale climate data to Minnesota, not from the data we are getting from the UK, but using data that's emerging at the University of Minnesota and the Minnesota Climate Adaptation Partnership. They're doing some downscale data for agriculture that we think we can leverage for the built environment. Also looking at modeling the impact of changing climate on energy efficiency and design. You know, again, how can we design those systems so that they're more cost effective? Understanding these impacts on site and water design to increase resilience at various scales, building scale, roadway scale, city scale, the entire kind of stormwater infrastructure. And then also, we believe there's additional research needed to assess these additional risks and impacts to develop the role infrastructure can play to reduce those impacts. Things like improving construction standards on the way we put roofs on, the way we put walls together to address some of the challenges we heard from the previous testifier in the insurance industry. They're actually simple, low-cost, no-cost ways of just changing installation patterns that can reduce some of those damage costs over time. So thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee, and thank you, Representative Lee.
Thank you very much. With that, we will turn it to member questions. Representative Igo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I guess my first question for this report that we'll be getting, and this is probably for both of you, for this report we're getting, what will be the margin of error on the research for these projections?
Professor Graves?
Yes, definitely you'd get margin of error because these predictions for the projections and then also even when we integrate them into design modeling, we will identify if there's if there are margins of error depending upon the thing that we're working on.
Right. And I just want some clarification on that because when we talk about this kind of stuff, you know, it's all statistics, right? Then it's compounding, compounding, compounding. And if you go out years in advance, you know, your margin of error dramatically grows. And I just think that's going to be really important to show in here because that's why you have so many climate models that say we're going to be at this point or we're going to be way down here because it's, I mean, statistics. And frankly, it baffles the human mind when we talk about statistics. So, but my last question I wanted to ask, and this is more for you, Representative Lee. I was wondering if the bill could consider adding an amendment that would do something around making sure that we have manufacturing and supply chains to coincide with their findings.
Representative Turley.
That's a conversation that we could have offline, Representative Igo, and as we move the bill forward.
Awesome. Thank you. Thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I'll be quick. The bill title deals with public infrastructure, again, on line to the bill author, on lines 120 to 123, you're talking about food production, forested land, water quality, and natural habitats. What's the connection?
Charlie?
Thank you for that, Representative. I think the connection there is that when we're out there hearing from different communities, for example, the city of Windham, they were talking about how they want infrastructure funding from the state of Minnesota with their stormwater issue because, you know, they're in the drainage area of about 422 acres of farming land that has been tiled, and so there's increased waterfall coming into the city, so that's why they're coming to the state for infrastructure funding. And so I think that we need to take a holistic approach and look at some of these natural systems and as to why we are, you know, asking the state of Minnesota to invest in these local infrastructure.
Representative Anderson? All right. Well, with that, Representative Franson?
Madam Chair, I move to table this bill so that we can have a detailed discussion on the impacts of this bill as amended. As you know, that we're being in a rush to get to session. I can't possibly imagine us having anything but more presentations next week, so I don't see any harm in tabling this bill until next week so that members can ask questions. I'm very interested in myself why we are giving a $690,000 line item grant to the Institute on the Environment when we know that there has been issues with the Institute on Environment with a certain member who shall go unnamed where a position was handwritten for that individual for a position there. And I don't know why we can't have per se maybe the Center for American Experiment instead line item. So I think that
right.
We need to table
we're
this
gonna,
bill, have
yep.
a discussion next week.
We're going to vote then.
Then
so,
I'd like a roll call.
Okay. So the clerk will take the roll. We're voting to, so the motion is to table this bill. So it's a.
Chair Cagle.
No.
Chair Cagle, no. Vice Chair Curran.
No.
No. Lee Branson.
Yes.
Lee Branson, yes. Representative Acom.
Acom, no.
Acom, no. Representative Gilman.
Gilman, yes.
Representative Hornstein.
No.
Representative Bernstein, no. Representative Igo?
Igo, aye.
Representative Igo, aye. Representative Kraft?
No.
Representative Kraft, no. Representative Ream?
Ream, no.
Representative Ream, no. Representative Schultz?
Aye.
Representative Schultz, aye. Representative Smith?
No.
Representative Smith, no.
We still have a member here.
Sorry.
Oh, Representative Anderson.
How did I miss that? Sorry. Totally skipped. Representative Anderson.
That's okay. Anderson, aye.
There being 5 ayes and 7 nays, the motion does not prevail. So with that, I will renew my motion
and I'd
to
like a roll call on the bill.
Roll call being requested. I renew my motion to re-refer House File 1135 as amended to the Climate and Energy Finance Policy Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Cagle.
Aye.
Chair Cagle, aye. Vice Chair Curran.
Aye.
Vice Chair Curran, aye. Lee Franson.
No.
Lee Franson, no. Representative Acomb.
Aye.
Representative Acomb, aye. Representative Anderson.
Anderson, no.
Representative Anderson, no. Representative Gilman.
Gilman, no.
Representative Gilman, no. Representative Hornstein.
Aye.
Representative Hornstein, aye. Representative Igo.
No.
Representative Igo, no. Representative Kraft.
Aye.
Representative Kraft, aye. Representative Ream.
Ream, aye.
Representative Ream, aye. Representative Schultz.
No.
Representative Schultz, no. Representative Smith.
Aye.
Representative Smith, aye.
There being 7 ayes and 5 nays, the motion prevails, and you are on your way to Climate, Energy, and Finance. That as amended. That concludes our agenda for today. Our next hearing will take place February 15th in 120. We are going to, I know, I'm sorry, you guys. we're going to have a presentation from the Michigan Infrastructure Council. So that should be kind of exciting. So thank you all, and this meeting is adjourned.